But
this, of course, was during the heat of battle.
This was during the battle when he was captured. Two or three others had received wounds before they were captured, you know, fragments and that sort of thing.
And was there medical attention given to the wounded people?
They received medical attention, and a nurse came two or three times a week to dress their wounds, which was adequate except for two of them. That was the man I mentioned whose feet were in bad shape, and another man who'd taken a big piece of something in his side, and they needed more medical attention. I spoke to the camp commander in the best Vietnamese that I could about this. I said that I felt they needed more medical care and they should be sent to a hospital if possible. He seemed very uncomfortable with this. He said, I'm sorry, we'll do the best we can. The situation is temporarily very difficult for us, but please don't worry. I'll do the best that I can for these men.
What about for yourself? Did you get adequate medical attention?
Yes, I did. I didn't need any medical attention at that camp except for blisters, which I could take care of myself. But about 2 weeks later at the second camp, I came down with amoebic dysentery. And the cadre, I call him, that is the man who spoke English and who was in charge of prisoners, immediately had a nurse come and see me. And she gave me standard anti-diarrhea treatment, which didn't help very much. And so after about a day and a half, when it was apparent to them that I was really quite ill, I heard them talking about trying to get me a doctor. And so I waited all that day and all the next day, and finally, just before supper time on the second day, a doctor did arrive, a young man who'd been educated in Hanoi at medical school. He was very well trained. He examined me and prescribed appropriate therapy. Any of you who know medicine, he gave me chloramycetin, and I was really surprised because I expected at best that I'd get tetracycline, but he did have chloramycetin. And he also gave me fluids, intravenous fluids, by dermal clysis, and in 4 days my symptoms were gone.
Now, after you were released from prison by the Viet Cong, did you stay in Vietnam?
No, I returned to the United States for about 4 months, and then I went back.
And what was your job when you returned to Vietnam?
I returned to the project in Quang Ngai that I was working with before, which was basically three things. It was a child daycare center for refugee children, a rehabilitation center for civilians, primarily war injured, though we had some like polio and other cases. And then the third thing that I was doing was once or twice a week I was going to the local civilian prison, that is the provincial prison, where I was examining sick prisoners.
Now these what kind of prisoners were these?
Well, this is basically the province jail. In normal times, this would be where any person convicted and sentenced to jail would be sent. But at present, that is at the time I was there, I was told both by the prison officials and by the prisoners that 80% or more of the people in the prison were there because they were accused of political crimes.
So these would be Viet Cong or Viet Cong suspects, at least?
Well, presumably, though in my conversations with prisoners, it seemed to me that many, many of them were there because, one, they didn't have proper papers. Two, they'd been picked up in an unauthorized area, someplace it was thought they weren't supposed to be. Or in the case of the women, and there were usually somewhere between 150 and 300 women in the prison, they couldn't account for where their husbands were, and so they were put in jail for that.
Did you have any chance to discover whether or not these prisoners had been mistreated in prison?
Yes. As I say, I was examining sick prisoners. Almost every time that I went, I would see one or more prisoners who had been tortured, not in the prison itself, but in the province interrogation center. And he said, well, Yes, the Province Interrogation Center system was started by the Americans. The idea was to teach South Vietnamese enlightened intelligence and interrogation procedures. It's intended to be a total isolation center, but no torture is to be going on, and if it is, we'll stop it. So I said, please do. I saw him 2 or 3 days later, and he was quite embarrassed. He said, I'm sorry, I didn't know this, but the Province Interrogation Center has been turned over to the Vietnamese. We're no longer in control of it. There was still an American advisor assigned to the center, however. He said, since that's the case, I suggest that you go directly to the province chief, which we then did. The province chief at that time was Colonel Ton Tat Kien. I took my records along and I presented this to him. And he said, well, he said, you know, most of the prisoners that we take have been forced to work with the VC, and they're very cooperative and they tell us everything that we need to know. But sometimes we meet people who are very hard. Those are the exact words he used, very hard. And we have to use other methods. And these are used, he said, there are limits. And I said, well, it seems to me that any reasonable limits are being exceeded, that this is inhumane. And furthermore, even from your point of view, I would think it would be politically counterproductive. And I'm asking you to do something to stop this. He did not promise that he would stop it. After about 2 weeks, I began to see the same sorts of things again, and it's still going on.
So you saw bruises and broken bones from beatings. Any other kinds of torture that you had experienced with?
I was not able to document by physical examination any other methods, though my patients told me of the electrical torture such as been described with the field telephone. They told me of being forced to drink concoctions containing things like powdered lime. They also told me of being tied up and hung from the ceiling, sometimes upside down.
Okay, so
but I couldn't document this.
One last question. What dates are we talking about? When were you working at this interrogation?
This was from September 1968 until October of 1969 in Quang Nai Province, just south of Da Nang.
Thank you, Doctor.
Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, folks, don't hesitate. Send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why.
Regular afternoon programming until 5 p.m. to broadcast the conclusion of the Winter Soldier investigation. On Saturday, February 6th and Sunday, February 7th, WBAI presented some 18 hours of the Winter Soldier investigation, but was unable to conclude it at that time because of a power blackout in Manhattan that knocked us off the air, so we will conclude it this afternoon. The Winter Soldier investigation was held in Detroit, Michigan from Sunday, January 31st through Tuesday, February 2nd, and was held under the auspices of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. During those 3 days, more than 100 veterans of the war in Vietnam, from units ranging from the AmeriCal Division to the Green Berets, from military intelligence officers to military information officers, testified about atrocities in Vietnam, atrocities that they personally witnessed, and in some instances, atrocities that they themselves committed. Despite the import of the event, the Winter Soldier investigation received little attention from the media, and that's one of the reasons why WBAI has been presenting this GI testimony in full. Each GI that testified carried some form of proof with them. All of them presented their military discharge papers to the press, detailing their ranks and where they had served and what training they received. Others brought color slides of atrocities, and one presented a SATCOM badge, a badge received upon the presentation of an ear from a dead member of the opposition. Coming up next is the medical panel.
Formerly a major in the U.S. Army Medical Corps, I have my DD-214 right here, which is an honorable discharge form. I was a psychiatry neurology consultant in Vietnam. Between 1964 and 1965, I also functioned for 5 months as a flight surgeon in the Mekong Delta. I was deputy surgeon of the United States Support Command at the time. When I returned from Vietnam, I must admit that I wasn't happy with our policy there before I went there, even in 1964, just after the overthrow of Diem. When I came back, I was extremely disgusted and I resigned my commission. I'd like each of the panel members to introduce themselves. They would. Why don't we start with you, Mark? Go ahead. Does it work?
Is this one on?
Yeah.
My name is Michael Erard. I served as a medic with the 173rd, 3rd of the 503rd.
My name is Joseph Grasso. I was a general medical officer for the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam.
My name is David Galacia. I served as psychiatrist, Third Field Hospital, Saigon, Republic of Vietnam.
My name is Jeff Dubrow. I was a hospital corpsman on the USS Sanctuary in Da Nang.
My name is Dave Fort, and I served as the driver for 3rd Medical Battalion, 3rd Marine Division in Quang Tri.
My name is Gary Steiger, and I served as the medic in the 366th USAF Dispensary at Da Nang.
Okay, thank you. First thing we will try to demonstrate is there was a variance of treatment which was not medically sound in terms of preference for patients. That is, Americans got the best treatment. If an Arvin had the same type of problem, wound, what have you, he got the second best. Prisoners got the worst by far. And we're going to take it by subjects. Mike, why don't you start off with something about how prisoners were treated by our medical people.
We had a policy whereby prisoners were given just the basic treatment. In other words, there may be a bandage or a field dressing was put on a wound. We were instructed, and this was battalion SOP, that we were to expend no medical supplies on them. In other words, specifically, we had we carried a small bottle of serum albumin, 500 cc's, to be used for people who were in shock or had serious wounds. When we went out in the field, we were told this costs $25. It's never to be used on a gook, meaning both Vietnamese and prisoners.
Anybody else want to comment on it? Dave, what about you? What have you seen happen with prisoners?
Basically,
just working.
Yeah, I think it's going now. Basically, in regard to a lot of various incidences, but I can relate one specifically to you, where a prisoner would be brought in to triage, which is immediately where they're operated on, or not operated on, but they get their basic medical treatment in there before they go on to their specific needs, like operations and things which had to be performed directly by a doctor. Well, they're in triage. A prisoner would then, he'd be interrogated. They'd come down with ITT, which is intelligence and translations people, and they try and get information from the prisoners. And while they're doing it, if the prisoner wouldn't give information out by the questions they ask, they'd use various ways of torture. They'd poke at his wounds. I've seen him stand a prisoner up who had a stomach wound. His shoulder was torn up. They generally harass the prisoner until they can get any information out of him. In this particular instance, they couldn't get anything out of him. I don't even think he could speak. He was in pretty bad shape. They took him to an operating room. And in the operating room, he wasn't treated by a doctor such as Americans were. And it wasn't, I don't know, sterile conditions, even if they exist. It was less than normal in this case. What they did is, like, rather than having a doctor, which would work on an American, they'd have corpsmen, which is more, I guess you could say they were practicing or getting experience from working on the prisoners that came in. He was in pretty bad shape. They had very little regard whatsoever for the concern of him once they got him out of the operating room. All they were doing is, like, okay, we got to do it, so we're going to do it, you know. But, like, who cares whether he lives or dies? It's just something that has to be done. There was one doctor present. Other than that, the corpsman did all the major work. They set bones very sloppily. And I know if you can set a bone, probably a lot of people know this, that if you set it sloppily, it's going to come out crooked. They don't care. Like you've heard all this time through testimony. You're dehumanized, and yellow people in your eyes are just completely dehumanized. They're not even human. You have no regard for them, so you don't care what happens to them. And a prisoner is more so than anyone else. Instances like this go on all the time. This is just one I could bring up. I don't know what happened to him once he left that operating room.
Maybe you said that there was an American doctor present when they tortured this guy? Or?
When the interrogation people came in, he was still in triage. He was laying on a stretcher. He's in really bad shape. ITT is intelligence. It's translations. It's getting information from prisoners and working a little bit with civilians. But they came in. There's a doctor present. The doctor's not concerned with intelligence. But ITT, they had a captain in this case, which is a Marine officer, and two Arvin, South Vietnamese intelligence people, one which was an officer, one which was a staff officer, or staff sergeant. And they're the ones who interrogated him. The officer was present. He ignored the interrogation. As a matter of fact, he almost went along with it. He didn't actually touch the prisoner, but he didn't say anything to stop the torture, whatever you want to call it, that was going on.
Okay, what about treatment of Arvin or civilians? I think, Jeff, you had seen some things that
I worked in the surgical unit on board the sanctuary, and most of the minor surgical procedures that were done on the sanctuary were done in the recovery room, such as debridement of wounds or minor suturing cases, things like that. And an Arvon soldier came in one day, and this one doctor, who I've seen do this about 10 times, I set him up for his procedure. It was a debridement of a wound, and it's done under a local anesthesia, like xylocaine or novocaine. And I set the tray out, and I drew up 10 cc's of xylocaine, and the Arvon was pretty apprehensive about what was going to be happening to him, so we had the interpreter tell him what was going on, and he calmed down. And about 5-10 minutes later, he was screaming like crazy. You know, I ran over to see what was the matter, and I noticed that the syringe hadn't been touched, and the doctor was performing this procedure without anesthesia. And he has done this about 10 times. I've seen him do it. And he was a lieutenant commander, by the way, which is like a major. So he knew better. Also, the same doctor claimed, like, in some case, he was rushed, like, from one case to another, like, in suturing cases. And I've seen him perform suturing cases without the use of sterile technique. In other words, no gloves. And it only takes 15 seconds to put a glove on, you know. So there was no excuse for that. This was, like I said, done only on Arvon soldiers, not Americans. Another doctor, who's a lieutenant commander also, performed 27 out of 30 negative laparotomy cases. A laparotomy is cutting into the abdomen and exposing the intestines and repairing any tear or wound that would be, you know, in the intestines. And the x-rays would come in with the patient from triage or from x-ray or wherever. And I put the x-rays up on the screen, so I saw every x-ray that came in on these patients. And you could see a metal fragment in the intestine. It stands out like a sore thumb. It's just like a big, you know, lump in the middle of, you know, like nothing. You can really see it. And if, let's say, an Arvon or a Vietnamese civilian would come in with, like, a fragment wound of the, you know, arm or leg or something like that, he would automatically order a laparotomy, you know, to be set up on him. You know, and we can't question him because I'm only an E4 and he was a lieutenant commander, so I had to do what I was told. So he would do these cases that didn't have to be done, and a laparotomy can be, you know, an easy case. If it's like, if there's a frag there, you could take the frag out, repair the, you know, the wound, and that's it. If sometimes it can be a very, you know, bad case, it could be a lot of bleeding done. I've seen fellows, you know, from a simple frag wound in the stomach, you know, die in surgery. And he would do these cases, you know, and they wouldn't have to be done. And like I said, it was 27 out of 30 negative cases. That's about all I have to say.
In an American hospital, we would be kicked off any staff. Tell me, Jeff, you're pretty knowledgeable about medicine. How much training did you have to be a man?
I went to basic hospital core school. And orthopedic technician school in Philadelphia, and an OJT OR technician in Vietnam.
And what are you doing now?
Nothing.
Why?
Civilian hospitals, somehow, they think that Navy corpsmen or any Army medics or whatever, the only thing they're good for would be making beds and passing out bedpans. They think the training we have is insufficient, and they won't give any ex-medics a chance to prove themselves. So, needless to say, medics, you know, won't work in a lot of civilian hospitals because after what they've done in Vietnam or in the service, even if they haven't gone over there, like, they don't want to push bedpans around all day. They want to get into, you know, down to the nitty-gritty and really get into some work. But they can't do this.
You can probably do most things a nurse can do, right?
Most things nurses can do, I can do probably more than a nurse can do. I've nurses cannot suture. I've sutured. I've debrided wounds where nurses can't. So.
Okay. What about in the triage? Gary, you want to explain what triage is and how it worked in terms of Vietnamese versus Americans?
Well, sometimes when we had days, we worked 6 days a week in Vietnam in our dispensary, and you could get pretty bored on your days off because it wasn't really a heck of a lot to do. And there were I think, 6 hospitals in the area, including the ship that Jeff was on. And oftentimes the Air Force medics would go to the Navy or Marine hospitals, and I worked quite a bit in those places. And triage is a system whereby the patients are divided into 3 main categories for treatment. If you have a person coming in who has is really badly wounded, he may have a limb or two missing or multiple shrapnel wounds or whatever, he is usually placed in a category, and expect him to die. He's placed in a category expectant. Right after those people come the guys that, if they weren't treated immediately, would possibly die. The people in the expectant category, chances are they wouldn't make it even with surgery. And the third category is the delayed, in which your guys come in, maybe have minor wounds or things like this. When patients came in, not only to the Navy hospitals and others, but when they came into our casualty staging flight where I worked, these patients would usually be the ones that were treated last. You could have an American come in an expectant category who there was no way that he was going to make it. And the doctors would oftentimes treat him before they would treat an Arvin soldier or an NLF soldier or whatever in a lower category who had a really good chance of making it if he was taken care of. Most of the time, the corpsman would give him basic first aid, and that was it. Like, you know, you weren't supposed to use any more of your supplies on them than was absolutely necessary to get them out of your facility and to a Vietnamese hospital. Now, the prisoners that I saw that we handled, they were taken into our hospitals, they didn't receive treatment. I mean, it's no way to, like, how to lose the words. I mean, they were lower than worms as far as these people were concerned. I mean, you don't treat worms and you don't treat Arvin. It was about the same thing. When they came and we bring them in on a medevac, the Air Force flies cargo planes. They're hooked up for carrying litters, and they carry wounded personnel and so forth on them. These planes would come in, and you have a C-130, which could maybe carry 60 American wounded, would come in with over 100 Vietnamese on it. Well over 100, stacked on top of each other and everything else. These people would get off, they'd be taken off the plane, you'd have a man, they're saying a body cast, it's, you know, cast from his neck to his knees, and he'd be walking down the ramp and somebody would trip. This guy'd fall 3 feet. He maybe has half the bones in his body broken, and the doctor has spent hours in an OR working on him, and they drop him from 3 feet. We put them into buses, and they were tossed into the buses more than put. We take them down to the Arvin hospitals instead of taking them to a place where they could be treated. They'd be taken there. And even if the Arvin didn't have the facilities, which they don't have, to treat these patients, we'd leave them anyway. The prisoners were transferred. Oftentimes, there's, I think, several hospitals that take care of these. One was where John was at. It is at Vung Tau, and there's one at Chu Lai. And it was common knowledge amongst the people that were working on the flight line transferring these prisoners. They were turned over to the Koreans. And it was a standing joke that at the Korean hospital, that if you had a patient who was really bad off, and you were sending someone down there who wasn't quite so bad off, and they didn't have the beds, that the one in the bed that was going to die anyway, we'd either be shot or something else done to them so they'd have room. And this happened all the time. The patients that we got in our casualty staging flight would sit up in the end of the ward, and if you were lucky, you could give them some water. It wasn't worth your time to treat them. And that's the way I saw it. And unless we can realize that those people are human beings and they were killing human beings over there, and that they are the same flesh and blood that which we are, I don't know. We're just not human beings ourselves.
Okay, I'm going to throw this kind of open to you, because I'm sure you've all had experience with it. There's a program in Vietnam that started probably was the first major